From KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 2009, the poet Craig Arnold went to Japan to climb volcanoes. It was part of a writing project. In April, he disappeared while hiking on a remote island. And after weeks of searching, all anyone could find were his footsteps. His longtime partner, Rebecca Lindenberg, wanted to tell the story of their life together. But she says she resisted a traditional narrative form. And after all, she is a poet. So she wrote poems. Her collection is not just about his disappearance. She says she didn't want that to eclipse the details of his work and his love, his being. Today in the program, Lindenberg is joining us to read from her book, to talk about poetry and the problem she's working out with it, how you find the right language for love and for grief. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There is a story in Rebecca Lindenberg's new book of poetry, a story about her longtime partner, the poet Craig Arnold, and how in 2009 he went to Japan and disappeared while climbing a volcano. And many of the poems are about grief and being left behind. In The Girl with the Ink-Stained Teeth, she writes about the tall, tall man who vanished, leaving her nothing, not even her name. But she began writing the book years before he died, so it's also about loving a man very much alive. It's about his work and his influence on her own. Today in the program, Rebecca Lindenberg is joining us to talk about her book. It's called Love, an Index. We invite you to join us if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from you on Facebook and Twitter. Rebecca Lindenberg's new book, poetry, it's the first title we should mention in the publisher McSweeney's new poetry series. It's received a lot of attention, including a glowing review in Vanity Fair magazine. She's received a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts. She's an adjunct professor of English at Utah State University, and she's joining us here in the studio. And welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I guess the first thing I wanted to talk about is I had mentioned that you had written this book years before Craig vanished. Was it a book then? What were you thinking about in terms of did you know where it was going at the time, if that makes sense?
I did. I had some sense. I began the book in 2006 when Craig and Robin and I were living in Rome. Craig had a Rome Prize fellowship at the American Academy there. And it's a place that definitely excites the imagination. It was hard not to find myself sort of wandering through these various kind of ruins and find myself in a different language, which was all around me and yet somehow made a kind of silence because I didn't yet speak it. And the poems sort of began to accumulate. And as I began, you know, I didn't set out with a project. I sort of encountered a series of discrete occasions that suggested themselves as poems, and it quickly became visible to me that I was writing about my family and I was writing about love. And at first I was really uncomfortable with that in sort of the scene of contemporary American poetry and letters. There seems to be kind of less and less room for sort of quote-unquote sentimental things like love. So as I started working on the book, I did a lot of research into sort of the love lyric in the in the Western tradition and realized this isn't sentimental stuff. This is, you know, sometimes it's a political assertion. Sappho uses it that way. Sometimes it's a spiritual encounter in John Donne's poetry, for instance. So I began to feel more and more confident that I wasn't just writing my love story. I was writing about love poetry.
But what? But why? That's so interesting, though, that I think it seems a little sad that it's almost like you had to go look for this academic justification for do this thing that you felt like you wanted to do. You wanted to write about love, but you had to go find out about the fact that this Greek lyric poet also did it. And right? That seems sad to me in some way.
Oh, I don't know if it's – I don't know if it's sad, actually. I mean, the reason I did it primarily was out of my own curiosity. You know, yeah. Why is it that when I look around at books of poetry today, I'm not seeing as much written in this vein as others? So it was mainly a line of inquiry that I was pursuing. It wasn't that I felt that I was writing on the defensive, that, yeah. If I wrote love poetry, nobody would listen to me. It was sort of this question I had, why am I one of a very small handful of people who are doing this right now?
Yeah, yeah.
So that kind of drove a lot of the research, I suppose, that went into the book, for sure.
It is interesting because you have talked about the fact that a lot of contemporary poets do feel a little defensive. And as you said they write defensively because it seems like such a, I don't know if this is the right word, but such an academic exercise in some way, that they're sort of bracing themselves for the critique that inevitably comes, I guess, right?
Well, some of that, I think, has to do with the kind of the workshop model that a lot of contemporary poets are coming out of, which I think is evolving and changing in a lot of ways in a lot of places. But traditionally, the workshop model has been sort of a group of people who bring their poetry to a classroom and then sit there in cowed silence while professors and peers tell them everything that's wrong with it, which it doesn't exactly, you know. And I think that model has been good for a lot of poets. I think there's a really interesting discussion happening right now as to whether or not it's good for poetry, which we could talk about for an entire show on its own, and so we won't.
Well, maybe we'll come back to it. But what I'm interested in is, so it was the I guess if it was a I won't say that it was a monolithic thing, this collection, yet, maybe, but did, I hate to put it this way, when Craig disappeared, did that give it a kind of new sort of purpose? Did it then become a book?
Yeah, I think so. Well, the direction of the project and my sense of urgency about it obviously changed. I worked on it really slowly because I was at the same time working on my PhD, actually, here at the U.
Yeah.
And so I was busy teaching and researching and preparing for my exams. But after Craig passed away, my focus and my sense of urgency changed really dramatically. And interestingly, in a way, the structure of the book reflects this. The first half or so, or early versions of the first half of the centerpiece title poem, Love and Index, were pieces that Craig actually saw and really liked. I remember thinking, I don't even know if this is a good idea for a poem. You know, I'll show him, and you know, I trust his judgment, so I'll take his advice. And he said, no, this is really smart. I really like what you're doing here. And then about halfway through the poem, which is about halfway through the book, Craig disappeared.
Yeah.
So that disappearance is kind of almost in the centerfold of that poem and of that book in the section K of the index. And then the rest of the index, the rest of the book really kind of contends very directly with that, not just that loss, but trying to use language to comprehend it and to understand how language relates to how we grieve.
Yeah, which I want to talk about. Mm-hmm. I want to have you read a poem which you've titled, which, if I never thought to mention it before, I now feel compelled to address. What I like about this piece, there's a kind of, I won't say eerie, but there's something really nice about the fact that I'm experiencing him now with you before he disappears. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. This is actually the first poem that I wrote that became part of this collection. This was sort of where it all began. And well, shall I read it?
Please.
Okay. Which, if I never thought to mention it before, I now feel compelled to address. Tall, 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 tall man. You bend so as not to dent the firmament. You're made of elements I've never tasted. I crave you, tall man. I love your strident devotion to the real as knowable. I love your bump but a bum. I love your thumbtacks and shrouds. Wrap me in your arms and teach me how to carol the moon in a way that pleases it. Yes, sometimes I want to pick up my shadow and sling it at you. Yes, you make me so angry I burst into green, green flames. I love you. Forgive me. I have made you the object of poems. I have subjected you to much wheezing. Oh, tall man, love me like a hero, and I will give you an arrow from my quiver. Bump-ba-da-bum. Sublime, sublime, sublime.
You met, this is hard to believe, you met Craig Arnold on Emily Dickinson's birthday, is that right?
Yeah, December 10th.
It was at a bar. Would you talk about that, the time you met him? It's a nice story.
Yeah, it was December 10th of 2001, and it was at a poetry reading. Two mutual friends of mine from my alma mater, William and Mary, were reading, and Craig happened to know one of them from Bread Loaf Writers Conference. Craig was a Hodder Fellow at Princeton at the time, and I was living in New York City working in publishing. And it was right after September 11th, which was a really, really anxious and volatile time in the city. So, you know, everyone was, I think, you know, still kind of walking around vibrating on a different frequency. And partly in response to the events of September 11th, actually, and sort of a desire for community, my friend Jess Piazza and I co-founded a poetry reading series called the Speakeasy Series. And I had gone to David Lehman's KGB Bar reading series sort of to see my friends and sort of in hopes of poaching poets for my own series.
Right.
And I was supposed to meet a friend who ended up not coming. And, you know, I was so anxious and didn't really kind of want to be alone in this space. Like I said, it was a kind of irrational time in the city. I almost didn't go to the reading, but I did. I went alone and sat down at a table kind of along the wall, and there was this tall guy in a leather jacket and a beret sitting next to me, and I remember thinking, could you be any more cliche? Who does this guy think he is? And we sort of started chatting, and it turns out that he was really friendly, and I asked him if he was a poet, and he kind of said, you know, yeah, I am. And after the reading, I said, well, you know, I've started this reading series, so if you don't mind, you know, I mean, maybe you'd come into the series and read for me. Could I have your contact information? And he wrote down his name and his email, which was greatdarkman@yahoo.com. And again, I was like, oh, come on.
You're rolling your eyes.
And then I went home and Googled him, and up came, you know, like, 75,000 pages of, like, the Amy Lowell Traveling Poets Prize, the Yale Younger Poets Series, you know, the Hodder Fellowship, the NEA. So he had won virtually anything that you can win as a poet under the age of 40. And I thought, well, wow, you know, given what I actually know now, he was relatively, you know, sort of gracious and humble, where I had kind of thought him to be like a little bit uppity at the time.
And you asked him to read.
I did.
Your series.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm interested in, too. What was it like when, because you've talked about the fact that for and this isn't the case for all poets, but certainly was for him, that this was really a performance.
Mm-hmm.
Reading a poem was really performing.
Yeah, especially from his first book, Shells. He memorized a lot of those poems, and he would sort of, you know, his readings were a legend. He'd get up on the stage in black leather pants and sort of prance around, gesturing, and he was really involved at some point with slam and performance poetry, and he brought a lot of that energy to the reading of his work. That was really important to him. I think that poetry should come off the page was something that Craig was really committed to, and is also something I learned a lot about from him and from being in conversation with him. Even then, when we were, you know, we were friends for quite a while before our relationship began, and I remember being, you know, just sort of awed by his audacity as a poet and as a reader and as a personality, really, as well.
It's interesting, this project, writing project he takes on. He started thinking about it when you mentioned being in Rome, and he was going to finish his book, Made Flesh,
mm-hmm.
but but he really got bogged down. I mean, I guess writer's block or something, because you have said, get out of here. Go what? Clear your head?
Well, he had a studio at the American Academy, and we had an apartment, and I was meant to work in the apartment, and he was meant to work in the studio. But there was a month or so where he was coming home from his studio at, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning every single day and wanting to sit there and talk about why he couldn't write. And, you know, I was trying to be really supportive at first. I sort of thought, well, try this and try this. And, no, I'm so sorry. No, I know it's really tough. And finally I was like, I also have work to do. You need to go away and do something. Go change something. You know, make something different, and then maybe, you know, that'll solve the problem. And I basically said, look, you know, why don't you just go away for a weekend? Like, you know, Robin and I could use a break from the drama, and you could use a change of scenery, I think. You know, this has sort of become too routine to break this routine. As writers, you know, bad habits are easy to form, yeah, but necessary to break. And so he got on the train and he went to Sicily, and he climbed Etna on kind of a whim with a group of, like, he sort of attached himself informally to a group of German tourists. And he was so taken with it that then he also went to Stromboli, which is a small island very near Etna, and it looks like a child's drawing of a volcano.
You know? Wait, he was taken by what, the volcano?
Yeah. Because it's also a very active volcano, so you can walk to a volcanic observatory and watch it kind of, you know, to use Craig's words, you know, it's like the volcano money shot. It sort of spews lava into right. the sky, and he says, you know, do it again. So, you know, that was, I think, kind of the beginning for him of a project that then became sort of two different projects. You know, one of them was this sort of series of lyric essays that he was writing, visiting volcanoes and using the volcano as kind of a trope. And the other, he called it his Birds, Beasts, and Flowers, after D.H. Lawrence's terrific poetry collection of that name, which was sort of, you know, returning to kind of naturalist roots, which he always had in him as a person, but hadn't really as deeply written about before.
What was the thing about volcanoes? I mean, I'd read there's a nice piece of writing from a musician, Christopher Blaisdell, who talks about Craig, that he was taken by the cycles of destruction and creation. Mm-hmm. That was his explanation. Does that get at it, do you think?
Yes, I think that's part of it. I mean, knowing Craig, I suspect that it was something he himself was still discovering as he was working on the piece. But one of the things I always understood about Craig was that he was in a kind of relentless pursuit of the sublime. And he talks a lot in his poetry, and he talked a lot in his life about a sort of hunger for wonder. And I think that something as unpredictable and as, you know, literally and metaphorically tectonic as a volcano really addressed that longing for him. And, you know, and I think that the experience that he had of fear and risk and but also of just a kind of awe in the presence of these volcanoes, I think that really enlivened him emotionally and intellectually and created a space for writing that hadn't been there before in quite the same way.
You know, it's interesting. You don't get a sense that this was just a man who was this kind of brooding loner, though. I mean, I think that this is another thing that Blaisdell was writing about. He talked about how this is in fact what Craig wrote in his application. He wrote this application to get this grant, I guess it was, to work with this group. And he said he wanted to converse with people who live in their shadows, the shadows of volcanoes, with other travelers, other writers, and record impressions of landscapes, both natural and social. So this was a thing that he wanted to talk to people. He didn't want to just do this alone, right? I mean, he wanted to interact with people and talk to people.
Yeah, he had. I mean, he became friends and remained friends with guides who had taken him up volcanoes in Nicaragua and had written them into the pieces as these very full, you know, rich, real characters. And it really, one of the things that was remarkable about Craig as a person, you know, when I think of him now, one of the things that is most impressionable to me is his generosity as a person. If you needed a ride home from the airport and he was within like a 100-mile, you know, radius of that airport, you had a ride home from that airport. You know, and there were times that we'd go out to dinner with a bunch of friends or students, and Craig would just, you know, throw down his American Express card and buy rounds and rounds of drinks for everybody just to make sure everyone was having a good time. And then, you know, when you live with him as a family, that becomes sort of frustrating 2 or 3 days later when you're eating like peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. But a major characteristic of just who he was as a person was this effusive and impulsive generosity that he had always, that he always had in his writing and in his life.
Is there anything, I'm looking at the poems, earlier poems that I want to have you read as we head into a break, which sort of maybe get at who he was. You know, Fragment mm-hmm. comes to mind. Mm-hmm. So does Catalog of Ephemera. Which makes the most sense?
I'll read the catalog.
Okay.
Yeah. Let me just flip to that page. Here we go.
You want to say something about this?
Well, I suppose it speaks in some ways to that feeling of generosity I was just talking about, which is maybe why it seems so apt at the moment.
When did you write this?
Let's see. It must have been 2005 or 2006, yeah. Right around the same time as I was.
Again, a time before you'd vanished.
Yeah. This was, you know, a lot of these sort of memories also of my early friendship with Craig, and then this as this sort of transformed into a romantic relationship, and we became a family. Catalog of Ephemera. You give me flowers resembling Chinese lanterns. You give me hail for yellow. You give me vex. You give me lemons softened in brine, and you give me cuttlefish ink. You give me all 463 stairs of Brunelleschi's dome. You give me seduction, and you let me give it back to you. You give me you. You give me an apartment full of morning smells, toasted bagel and black coffee and the freckled lilies in the vase on the windowsill. You give me 24 across. You give me flowers resembling moth's wings. You give me the first bird of morning alighting on a wire. You give me the sidewalk cafe with plastic furniture and the boys with their feet on the chairs. You give me the swoop of homemade kites in the park on Sunday. You give me afternoon colored beer with lemons in it. You give me D.H. Lawrence, and he gives me pomegranates and sorb apples. You give me the loose tooth of California, the broken jaw of New York City. You give me the blue sky of Wyoming and the blue wind through it. You give me an ancient city where the language is a secret everyone is keeping. You give me a T-shirt that says all you gave me was this T-shirt. You give me pictures with yourself cut out. You give me lime blossoms, but not for what they symbolize. You give me yes. You give me no. You give me midnight apples in a car with the windows down. You give me the flashbulbs of an electrical storm. You give me thunder and the suddenly green underbellies of clouds. You give me the careening of trains. You give me the scent of bruised mint. You give me the smell of black hair, of blonde hair. You give me Apollo and Daphne, Pan and Syrinx. You give me Echo. You give me Hyacinth and Narcissus. You give me foxgloves and soft fists of peony. You give me the filthy carpets of an East Village apartment. You give me seeming not to notice. You give me an unfinished argument begun on the Manhattan-bound F train. You give me paintings of women with their eyes closed. You give me grief and how to grieve.
How to grieve. Gosh, this is a dumb question, and I'm not suggesting it was any kind of a premonition, but isn't that interesting?
Well, it's occurred not only to you but to other people as well. I mean, a lot of Craig's poems, especially in Made Flesh, which was at the time I was writing this poem, a group of pieces that I was really familiar with. I was helping Craig to edit them and arrange them and think about them and talk about them and a lot of Craig's own work is about grief. And so when I think of, you know, when I think what I was originally thinking when I write, you know, you give me grief and how to grieve, it's sort of like, you know, it's you give me the grief of, you know, you keep coming to me with these things and saying, change it again, read it again, read it again. I'm like, oh, I have things to do. But how to grieve, you know, the hymn to Persephone, for example, one of the poems from Craig's book, Made Flesh, is this sort of beautiful kind of testament to the process of mourning. And I don't think that I had really contemplated the idea of grief and loss as profoundly or in as many with as many different kind of psychic and lyric resonances before Craig had started working on Made Flesh or had, you know, started involving me in his work on Made Flesh. And so I think that's what I was kind of thinking of at the time. Looking back on it, it feels a bit eerie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's – well, this is, I have to say, and this is one of the things that's so great about it is – no one can experience without that context now. Mm-hmm. So that's just yeah. what it is, whether that's good or bad.
I think it is what it is. You know, yep. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that you do when you, you know, you write poems is you it's, there's sort of an act of faith involved. You know, it's, I can know intimately where every one of those words and commas came from, you know, how they accumulate meaning and significance as time passes is sort of out of your hands as a writer, I think. And it should be.
Yeah. Rebecca Lindenberg is with us. Her new collection of poems is called Love and Index. And we need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the poet Rebecca Lindenberg is with us. She's written a book of poetry that is in part a reflection on her life with Craig Arnold, also a poet. You may have read the news accounts. He disappeared in 2009 while hiking toward a volcano in Japan. Her book is called Love and Index, and she's joining us here in the studio to talk about it. So I wanted to – there was something – it's interesting to read – I read a haiku that Craig Arnold had written about because he seemed to really like the difficulty of trekking up these mountains. Mm-hmm. Japan in particular, he's writing this – I guess this blog throughout the process. Mm-hmm. He talks about how at one particular volcano, it was really hard. The going is not pleasant. It's steep and slippery. And he says, you are more exquisitely attuned to the unique sensation of dragging your ankles through the snow that has fallen and melted and frozen again. So again, that I guess that sense of an experience, mm-hmm. The beauty of it, but kind of the agony too. And he wrote this really beautiful haiku. It is hard to feel moved by natural beauty when your socks are wet. It's really great. So you get a sense that he's all about this experience. And, of course, he arrives at this small island in April, late April. There's a volcano there. And he disappears.
Mm-hmm.
What's the first word you got that something was wrong?
It's funny, actually, Christopher Blaisdell, who you mentioned before, sent me a message through Facebook, which I got very early one morning, and it just said, can I have your phone number, please? I need to call you. It's urgent. It's about Craig. And I Facebooked him back. I mean, thank goodness, you know, really in a lot of ways for Facebook, which there's a Facebook poem in my book because Facebook becomes a kind of character in this story. But I wrote him back and sent him my phone number, and he immediately called me to explain that Craig had arrived at the island of Kuchina Arabushima around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which I knew because I had just spoken to him on the phone on the ferry on his way over. And he had checked into the only inn on the island and left all of his belongings and had gone for a solo trek at a sort of inadvisably late hour of the day. But he felt sure that he would be fine. He wasn't going that far. He wouldn't be gone that long. And he had to leave the next day. So he was not to be deterred. But when at 9 o'clock at night, he still had not returned to the inn. The innkeeper notified the local authorities, and they actually began searching for him immediately. And I was informed the next day, and then I let Craig's brother Chris know, and immediately we started trying to find out, you know, what happens now. Yeah. And of course, at the time, I was just absolutely certain that he'd twisted an ankle or something. And, you know, I was waiting to get a phone call from him any second saying, I'm so sorry to have worried you. You know, I'm fine. Everything's fine. I knew him to be like a competent outdoors person. And I was, you know, it didn't occur to me that what he was doing on this island could possibly have been dangerous in the first place. Yeah. After a couple of days, it started to become worrying, and usually the Japanese authorities will search for a missing person for 3 days. But they were very, very generous, and we persuaded them, and they made themselves persuadable, and they searched for him for 9 days, which, especially since this took place during Golden Week, which is sort of like Christmas here, I suppose, is an analogy, that was a really, really big deal.
Yeah.
And then we hired some independent search teams, two from the U.S. and one based in Japan, comprising sort of Japanese and Australian and New Zealanders. And so one after another, each one of them sort of tried to pick up the trail and try to make some logical conclusions as well based on just kind of what had been searched. And after about 2 weeks... I think I understood that the unthinkable had happened, that we weren't looking for my partner anymore. We were looking for his body. And I remember sitting down with my dad, actually, and, you know, I sort of intellectually knew this, but I had a lot of trouble really understanding it and at the time, I felt such panic during all of this time to find him. You know, I was very kind of identified with what he might be going through, and I needed to let go of that, or I was going to sort of stroke out. And I asked my dad, you know, Dad, do you think that he's gone? And my dad was crying, and I was crying, and he said, yeah, honey, he is. You know, just logically, he is. And to this day, we don't really have an answer to that mystery.
No. They didn't find anything. They found footsteps.
They found footprints, we think, although, you know, then later search teams kind of questioned whether or not those footprints, in fact, were Craig's. And so there remains a tremendous amount of mystery surrounding this. And people have suggested everything from foul play to he's went underground for the CIA, to kidnapped by North Koreans, to abducted by aliens. And while I also prefer the idea of Craig being in the world to not being in the world, I think we do understand a little bit that he went for a hike by himself and some manner of accident befell him and he was not able to recover from it. I think that's what we're left with for now.
Yeah. The poem Obsessional.
Mm-hmm.
I want to have you read this. At what point did you write this?
You know, it took me a very long time to write this poem, I think, because it took me a long time to admit to these things. I think...
Admit to what things? He's gone.
Well, partly that he's gone, and partly that maybe I'm not. There came a point at which, you know, I was so kind of doubled over trying to figure out what had happened that it took a while for me to admit to myself that it was possible that there was a part of me that didn't want to know.
Yeah.
That it might be worse than I could have imagined. And if that's true, would that haunt me more or less than not knowing? Which is a question I still really don't have an answer for, but there came a time when it became important for me to address that question for myself. So the poem is in the form of a villanelle, which is one of what we call obsessive forms because they have these repeating refrains. It seemed appropriate. So obsessional, and there's an epigraph here from the great contemporary American poet Martha Ronk. I'm tired of getting over things. What makes a man impossible to find on such a chip of land it's hardly there? Could it be worse than what I have in mind? I know where you are not, but I'm still blind to any trace of how or when or where. What makes a man impossible to find? I wonder, is this ignorance more kind than knowing what transpired? Does this spare my wits from worse than what I have in mind? I feel sometimes as though this world's designed to show me how without you can't compare to with you, man impossible to find. I still can't pack away things that remind me how you'd put your mouth around my ear and breathe into me what you had in mind. Someday, I hope I can become resigned to knowing it's not knowing I must bear. What makes a man impossible to find? Could it be worse than what I have in mind?
I wanted to ask you about something that you had said. You grew up, you were born in Minneapolis, moved to Palo Alto, your family moved to the Washington, D.C. area. Mm-hmm. And you've talked about the fact that your family, you grew up in this family of readers, that your mother actually hung this giant poster of a poem in your room?
Yeah, yeah. We grew up with poetry. She would make these enormous posters where she'd sort of print off, you know, sometimes it was the Jabberwocky, or sometimes it was, you know, we were kids, so sometimes it was a Shel Silverstein poem, or sometimes it was a scrap of a nursery rhyme. And then she would illustrate it. You know, my mother is a terrific illustrator, and so she would kind of draw her own art all over these posters and leave them for us to sort of fall asleep to. It was kind of – and she'd change them out every month or so. And that's one of many ways in which we were kind of constantly surrounded by books and poetry and language. I mean, you know, we had – like when we were young, we weren't allowed to watch R-rated movies, but we were permitted to read anything that we could get our hands on. And
right.
And I remember sneaking my mom's copy of Love in the Time of Cholera off of her shelf at one point because it had a naughty picture on the front, and then finding that it was comparatively really boring to like a 12-year-old. we did a lot of reading. We did a lot of reading aloud in our family as well. I mean, I was just sort of immersed in language in that family, and my family are tremendous storytellers as well. My mother works now for Scholastic book publishing, and she reads a lot of, well, she reads all of their catalog, and then she'll sort of come to me and say, oh, I just read this amazing book, and retell the story so well that I almost don't want to go read the book in case it's really disappointing.
Right.
Compared to the amazing job my mom has done telling it to me. So,
But I'm interested in how it is you're drawn to, because you've talked about this fascination you've always had with language. So what is a poem then? A poem is, you said that you write poems because you have something in your mind that you cannot say.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's when we come to the ends of ourselves that we sort of resort to figure. And, you know, different kinds, there are different kinds of ways that language works.
Yeah.
The poet Stefan Mallarmé talks about this in an essay from the late 19th century, where he talks about the difference between what he calls poetic language and what he calls journalistic language. And journalistic language is what you and I are using right now. It's language that we use to communicate in sort of clear, crystalline prose. So it's, the language becomes almost sort of a window pane that you look through to the idea.
Yeah.
Poetic language works really differently. Poetic language is a material that is much stranger and more marvelous, which I think is one of the reasons that a lot of people, my students often say that they think poetry is hard, because they read it and they say, wait, I speak English, this is written in English, and yet it's baffling me in some way. And I think that that makes them feel badly. But they shouldn't feel badly. It's supposed to do that. It wants you to relook at the language anew and think of it as something that's working in a little bit different way. So it's a little bit like walking into the house you grew up in your whole life to find all of the furniture made out of Jell-O. It can be really a really strange experience encountering a poem, but it's a tremendous one, and it gives you as a poet a lot of opportunity to work with that language to say more than just the language itself has to say. You can draw connected things into orbit around that kind of – that idea that cannot be expressed or said but can be got at in the poem. And I think that's an important function of poetry, and it's sort of the logic of poetry. It's a kind of lyric logic, which I think this sort of associative logic is what we mean oftentimes when we talk about lyric poetry.
So with that in mind,
mm-hmm.
where did this poem come from?
The Obad. Should I read it?
Yeah, but tell me, but just, again, it's weird because I don't want you to explain what it means necessarily, mm-hmm. but I mean, this was a reflection of what?
This is, I think, precisely a reflection of that sort of hollow at the center of the poem. That's almost a good analogy is almost dark matter in the universe. Right? We can't see it.
Yeah.
But we know that it's there because we can measure its effects on the things around it. We can measure its gravitational pull on stars and light and other bodies that orbit the dark matter. So we can understand a tremendous amount about it. We can know how much it weighs and how much mass it has, but we can't see it itself. And I think that there's something that this poem speaks to that relates to that, if I may.
Please.
Obad. And Obad is a dawn song. I woke in a gold dress, you in jeans. Morning filled wine bottles in the kitchen. Fine mica glitter of fish scales and salt. Outside, it was quiet. You said, that went well, don't you think? Sun behind you, I kissed the hole in the light and said, yes.
Rebecca Lindenberg, her new collection of poems is called Love, an Index, and we need to take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the poet Rebecca Lindenberg. We're talking about her new collection of poems called Love, an Index, and she's joining us here in the studio. So we were talking about language before, and you've written a poem called Losing Language, a Phrase Book, which I guess is this collection of people conveying their sympathies to you or mm-hmm. trying to make sense of it, and you trying to make sense of that.
Yeah, one of the things that, you know, we're always taught as poets is to reject the cliché, the familiar language for things, because they are, and I do think this, a sort of the kind of a evidence of sort of a failure of original attention, right? Clichés are kind of – they lose their meaning. They don't have much impact. They go kind of in one ear and out the other. But what I found – surprisingly to me, losing Craig was that I would get a lot of, you know, what you would call cliche responses from people. And at first, I was kind of like, you know, this doesn't really mean anything. And after I thought about it for a while, I realized that I was quite wrong about that, that cliches have a really important, really significant place, which is as placeholders. You know, if someone says, I'm very sorry for your loss, they do mean it. But what they also mean is, I want to reach out to you and say something meaningful to you, but I don't want to make it worse. Yeah. And I don't want to hurt you more. Mm-hmm. And so this is the sort of way of saying, I just want you to know that I'm here for you. And it's not – it's actually rarely – it takes so much courage, I think, for people to reach out to someone who is grieving and say something like that, that it is not dismissible. And, you know, I mean, I think it's hard for us to – I found that it's so hard for us to manage our understanding of our own pain. It's hard to empathize with yourself when you're in that amount of grief. It takes a huge amount of courage for someone else to reach out in empathy to you. And so, you know, I remembered when I sat down to write one day that Craig had once joked in his funny way and said, a cliche is just a poem that won. And I thought, gosh, that's great. You know, there's something really truthful in that. And so I sat down and thought, you know, I'm going to write kind of about those kind of stock, that code, if you will.
Yeah. Read a few of these, will you?
Yeah, I will. Losing Language, a phrase book. And the way it's structured, of course, is the cliches on one side and then the translation, quote unquote, on the other.
Yeah.
He lived a good life. I envied him a little. My condolences. You look like you've been trying to drown yourself. My sympathies. I fear to say something that might make it worse. Life goes on. Don't forget us just because we're still alive. He was doing what he loved. There is still such thing as a good death. He'll always be with you. You don't have to try so hard. He lived large. I saw him drunk. He laughed with his mouth wide open. He lived well. He knew things, how the soul is electrified running your thumb over a lover's bottom lip, how a good martini makes a breeze inside the skull. He was a wonderful father, whatever else I may have thought of him. It takes time. You changed to belong with him. You learned, for instance, that he made excellent poached eggs and liked driving long distances. Now you must relearn to spoon in just enough vinegar and how not to be hypnotized by the fleeting white dashed lines.
I want to have you read, I don't want to run out of time before you read this, a poem called Marblehead.
Great.
Will you say something about this briefly? I mean, maybe I should have you read it first because I want to make sure we have some time to talk a little bit about it. It was a poem that you had written, and I don't know if you put it aside, but, it became the last poem of the collection. Read it first, will you?
I will. Marblehead. This has an epigraph by the great James Schuyler. Not to be in love with you, I can't remember what it was like. It must have been lousy. You take off your black motorcycle jacket, hang it on the back of a chair. It's cold from our walk along the seawall. Your pockets jingle with shells. While we were gone, you left the stove on low. Some things you do make me so nervous. You graze the surface of sauce simmering in a pan, shiny fingertip held out for me to lick. You say, what does it need? Maybe nothing. Maybe honey to unbitter the lime. Later that night, you'll bury your face in my belly and sob, I'm sorry, though I don't think you are always talking to me, my love. But now, lobster steam billows up the window. You gulp purple wine, your pinky sticking out, and the round olives are the green, all green things aspire to be.
It's interesting because you mentioned earlier that you still would like to think he is still in the world, even though you don't believe it.
Yeah.
This does leave that sense of hope, though, doesn't it? This poem.
Well, I think I feel a sense of hope. I don't think that it's hope that he is coming back one day.
No, of course.
But I do think he is still in the world. I think he's still in the world in his own tremendous writing, in the magnificent influence that he had on the people he was close to, in his friendships and in his as a teacher and as a father and as a partner. I don't think that he will ever really be gone from the world. And, you know, I experimented with putting various things at the end of the book that gave what I think is an artificial feeling of that sort of vulgar term closure. And I don't really like the idea of closure, as it turns out, because I don't need to be done with Craig. And I don't think any of us who loved him or love his poetry need to be done with him. I think that one of the magnificent gifts that he gave us is his continued and enduring presence. So,
let me ask you this finally, there's less than a minute. You said you haven't disclosed everything in this book.
Yeah.
You kept some stuff to yourself.
Of course. I had to. And I will cherish those things in a private repository.
Rebecca Lindenberg, her book is called Love, an Index. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our theme music composed by The Moth and the Flame. Our thanks to Taylor Almond. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.